Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens, at the heart of Irish homes for over 40 years. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Now, NATO leaders will gather in Washington later today to mark the 75th anniversary of the Defence Alliance, but the event risks being overshadowed by increasing speculation about Joe Biden's candidacy in the forthcoming presidential elections. A shouting match developed at the White House press briefing yesterday as the press secretary, Karine Jean-Pierre, repeatedly faced questions about the president's health and whether visits to the White House by a Parkinson's doctor were for the president. In a feisty exchange with reporters, she declined to confirm Dr. Kevin Kennard's visit, citing privacy reasons, but she said that Joe Biden had seen a neurologist three times connected to his annual physical exams.
Wait, no. No, wait a minute, please. A little respect here, please. What I can tell you is that the president has seen a neurologist three times, and I read to you what the neurologist has said. No findings which would be consistent with any cerebellar or other central neurological disorders such as stroke, multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's, or ascending lateral sclerosis. That is from February. Has the president been treated for Parkinson's? No. Is he being treated for Parkinson's? No, he's not. Is he taking medication for Parkinson's? No. So those are the things that I can give you full-blown answers on.
That's the White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre, well, Professor of US and International Politics at the Clinton Institute in UCD. Scott Lucas is on the line. Scott, thanks for being with us this morning. Joe Biden is under fairly serious pressure now, but he's adamant that he's going to continue on as the Democratic nominee. Do you think in the face of Democrats coming out and saying that really it's time to go now, that he can hold on?
I think, Claire, this week may be the decisive week. Biden is a proud man. He is a man who I think still thinks he can defeat Donald Trump in November. He just doesn't want to go. He doesn't want to give way. But on the other hand, in the aftermath of that debate performance at the end of June and the inability of Biden to really restore confidence, you have got both House Democrats and Senate Democrats who will be meeting today to discuss seriously what the future is. You've got donors who have already said they will not contribute to the campaign while Biden is still in place. And the Democrats don't have the luxury of time. You have got the Republican National Convention next week. The Democrats' convention is on August 19th. And they need Biden to step aside so they can establish a replacement candidate in terms of that candidate's character, profile, policies, and especially the character's countering of the lies that are told by Donald Trump day after day after day, taking advantage of the fact that all the media attention is on Biden right now.
Mm-hmm. We were asking this question last week, and it's more pertinent now given his interview with George Stephanopoulos on ABC, where it would take the Almighty to come down and tell him to withdraw. That's the only way he would go. What do you think will push him out of the race? Because he is adamant in the face of all of these criticisms that he's going to stay on.
Well, I'm just going to give you a precedent from a different country, Claire, where I used to live, which was the UK. I can remember in 1990, after weeks of building pressure on her, Margaret Thatcher, pretty tough woman, said, "I'll persist. You know, I'm staying. There's no way I'm going." 48 hours, she was gone. Mm-hmm. And she was gone because there simply was enough of a cavalcade of people from within the Conservative Party, donors, activists, politicians, and strategists, who just said, if you stay on, it will just cause the party damage. It will cause the country damage. You need to step aside. Here we are 34 years later. The American system is different from the British one, but you're going to have a similar process in which the Biden's going to be approached privately, not publicly, and told, look, you said you were going to be a one-term president. That one term has been perhaps the most significant in American history since the 1960s. You can be proud of this, but if you stay on, instead of protecting democracy, you will be risking it, because you will open the door for an autocrat, Donald Trump, to stay in the White House. I think that appeal will be made to Biden. It'll be made to his wife, Jill. It'll be made to those who are around him. And I think if he continues to refuse, I don't think there'll be a public coup to overthrow him. But I think you see more donors and more politicians will publicly come out and say there is no alternative.
Mm-hmm. And then when it comes to the replacement candidate, we'll remember when Kamala Harris became vice president, the talk around her was that this is the succession candidate. Then they sort of pushed her into the background, gave her a really hard job on border control. And we haven't heard much about her since, apart from how unpopular she's been. Is she the likely candidate to replace him if that's how this plays out?
I think she's the favorite, Claire, and there's a couple of important updates on that. The first is the American media narrative on how unpopular she is, not exactly true. She runs neck and neck with Donald Trump in the polling. So if she was to become the candidate right now, you almost have a renewed start to the campaign over the next few months. Secondly, you're absolutely right that the Biden administration undermined her for years because, you know, they were preparing for Biden to run for a second term. But in the last couple of weeks, what Harris has been doing has been making high-profile appearances, still supporting Biden, but also establishing her own position. She gave a speech which was widely acclaimed in New Orleans last weekend, and she has another big appearance in Nevada this week. So the public, the media are being told, yeah, that preparations are being made for her to take over from Biden as soon as he does step aside.
How risky is that for the Democrats in this forthcoming election, though?
Oh, you're in a position where you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. I mean, if you don't right now and Biden runs against Trump, personally, I don't see any way that Biden wins this. And I think you also have the risk that he pulls down Democratic House and Senate candidates in an election where both chambers of the legislature are on a knife edge over a majority. So what do? You have to make the replacement now, not later. If you do it later, you have almost no chance of overcoming the barriers. Now what you can do is, one, establish your person, Kamala Harris or someone else, and two, equally important, you can finally return media attention to the serious flaws of a convicted felon, sex abuser, fraudster, serial liar, and coup plotter who happens to be the Republican candidate.
Who are the other possibles? Like, we have heard mention Gavin Newsom, Gretchen, her name escapes me now, is it Whitmer? Are any of those players, given that they're not really on the national stage. I mean, we had Gavin who made a play for it in the past, but they're governors of states. Would it be possible for them to run in this election and be successful?
I think it's possible. Now, none of them have put their names forward. All of them, again, continue to support Biden. Gavin Newsom would have enough profile pretty quickly if he ran. Gretchen Whitmer of Michigan, who is widely acclaimed for being very effective in a swing state, which is always important because you want to hold that state for the Democrats, I think is there. You've got people talking about a qualified transport secretary, Pete Buttigieg, who ran in 2020, Gina Raimondo, Commerce Secretary, former Governor of Rhode Island. The issue here is that I think Harris is the favorite in the sense that she's already in the administration. You can play on her role belatedly in those administration's achievements. And also, she does poll a little bit closer to Trump simply because, as you mentioned at the start of your question, she does have a bit more profile at this point than the others do.
There's no possibility, do you think, given that we saw that poll at the weekend, which showed that the only person who can beat Obama at the moment, if the election were happening today, is Michelle Obama. Do you think she might change her mind?
Well, you know who should be asking, and it's not me. Michelle Obama. Michelle Obama has said, you know, in the past, including back in March, that her life is not in politics. I think she and Barack wanted to devote more time to their family when he came out of the White House. They've got a very active media career with their involvement in documentary production. She's very involved in a whole series of activist campaigns. I think that's where she's happy right now. So no, I don't think she would come back into the frame.
Even though she might be put under considerable pressure from some elements within the Democratic Party.
I think what you would see is that once you settle on the replacement candidate, let's say it's a Kamala Harris, you would see Michelle Obama taking a very prominent role out there in the campaign, making appearances, and Barack Obama making appearances as well for a candidate like Harris. That's where their place would be.
Listen, there's another part to this issue as well, because getting Joe Biden out of the race will be playing not only into Donald Trump's hands, but also into the hands of Vladimir Putin. And has the possibility been raised of Russian interference in any of this push to get Biden off the stage?
Now, you know, the Russians are trying to exploit this in the sense that, that Putin quite cheekily said a few weeks ago, oh, I support Joe Biden to become president, just to throw everybody off track. But right now, you know, the Russians just simply can stand by and let the U.S. system run into its own trouble. Mm-hmm. They don't have to be intervening. And, you know, let's remind ourselves that only yesterday the Russians closer to home bombed children's and maternity hospitals in Ukraine, killing at least 37 people, wounding 170. So the whole Russian disinformation here is to continue to cause confusion in the West generally by saying you don't need to support Ukraine, and knowing that Vladimir Putin, who has failed to conquer Ukraine, that his get out of the invasion free card is if his friend Donald Trump is elected in November in the U.S.
Yeah, and that is why this NATO meeting is so important, marking the 75th anniversary of the alliance, because Donald Trump has, in the past, declared NATO obsolete, threatened to leave altogether. More recently then, Scott, we know that he said that he would allow the Russians to do whatever the hell they want. I mean, his election again in November would be a huge threat, would it be, to NATO?
Be a huge threat to all of us, Claire, including here in Ireland, because let's take it step by step. This is a man who in 2016 had Russian assistance to get elected, who publicly embraced Vladimir Putin in the years after that, who in 2019 blackmailed Ukraine, cut off its military aid because they wouldn't dish dirt on Joe Biden, who, as you mentioned, threatened on more than one occasion to pull out of NATO. He is a disruptor. He is a destroyer. What NATO is doing, and indeed what other organizations are doing across Europe, across the world, is they're Trump-proofing right now. NATO will probably announce $43 billion in aid for 2025 to Ukraine. That's on top of the EU committing 50 billion euros earlier this year in financial and economic support. And that is to ensure that even when Trump gets in, there's enough aid that's already in the pipeline that the agencies, not Trump, but the U.S. agencies can work with others to ensure that Trump does not, to ensure that Vladimir Putin is not able to conquer Ukraine with the de facto assistance of that guy in the White House.
And the horrible, awful irony of what happened yesterday with those missile attacks on Ukraine is that going into this NATO meeting, it refocuses minds on what's happening there, doesn't it?
It refocuses minds on what's happening in the sense that you... Let me be clear. I'd expect it's not just irony. I suspect the Russians were sending a message, which they quite often do before high-profile meetings. So they sent the message, we can hit Ukraine again and again, which sort of puts the challenge to NATO, what are you going to do about it? But let me tell you what the real horrible irony was yesterday, that a few hours after that attack, there was another world leader who pitched up in Moscow. His name wasn't Trump. His name was Narendra Modi of India, a man who purports to be on the side of peace and international stability, who a few hours after those women, children, and others were killed in those hospitals and elsewhere in Ukraine, gave Vladimir Putin a big hug.
Mm-hmm. So what do you believe NATO should be doing? I mean, you mentioned the $43 billion, which is the amount proposed for 2025 from NATO. And I know the EU has committed to give $50 billion. What more can NATO do at this meeting now to support Ukraine?
It's what you do at the meeting is that you publicize this. You give that statement of support. You also say that Ukraine is on track to NATO membership, not in the near future, but once this war is over and down the line. And I think all those statements will be made. What's important is what you do on a day-to-day basis beyond the meeting, which is you provide not just the headline aid to Ukraine, you provide the support in terms of logistics. You provide supply support. You provide intelligence support. You make sure that Ukraine gets the equipment that it needs to hold off the Russian invasion on the front line. And you make sure that Ukraine gets the equipment that it can use to hit Russia inside Russia and in Russian-occupied territory. And the sticking point right now is not whether or not NATO will give support to Ukraine, but do you allow the Ukrainians to fight back by, for example, hitting the Russian launch sites where they fire those missiles that are so deadly on a day-to-day basis. So it's an ongoing process in which, beyond the headlines about individual world leaders, do you have militaries, diplomats, and economic officials continuing to keep the efforts organized? Because one thing that people tend to forget. Vladimir Putin thought he could conquer Kyiv within a few weeks and that he could disrupt NATO. Not only did he fail to conquer Kyiv, NATO actually has expanded since February 2022 with Sweden and Finland as members. If NATO can continue to show that type of resilience and strength, then in what is a marathon, not a sprint, Ukraine can still stand despite what Mr. Putin and Mr. Trump may wish.
Yeah, I see Vladimir Zelensky now has just in the last few minutes condemned that visit that you spoke about, the visit of the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi to Russia. And Vladimir Zelensky said it's a huge disappointment and a devastating blow to peace efforts to see the leader of the world's largest democracy hug the world's most bloody criminal in Moscow on such a day being the day after this deadly Russian strike on the children's hospital. And that attack has been condemned by Pope Francis, who has voiced grave sorrow over the missile strike. He's expressed deep distress at the escalation of violence in Ukraine and in Gaza. And the United Nations has said there was a high likelihood that the children's hospital suffered a direct hit from a Russian missile. Scott, we'll leave it there for now, but thank you so much for your time. That's Scott Lucas, who's Professor of US and International Politics at the Clinton Institute at UCD. Back after this.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.